If you have kids, you have probably noticed that STEM is everywhere. On packaging for toys, on websites for schools, in brochures for summer camps and children's museums. Everyone wants in on STEM. Science, technology, engineering, and math. But lately, some people are saying STEAM. Have you noticed that? The A stands for arts. You'll also hear about STREAM with an R for reading. So what's up with all these acronyms? It is very confusing. Also, a little unclear what it actually has to do with how kids learn. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're going to sort it all out on KCUR's Central Standard. I want to start with Martha McCabe. She's the executive director of the KC STEM Alliance. Hi, Martha.
Hi.
So give me a little background on STEM, because that's where this all started. What is STEM, and why do people talk about it so much?
So, you know, STEM is an acronym that does stand for science, technology, engineering, math, as you alluded to a few minutes ago. But it's really the integration of those subjects and a way in which students can find the relevancy of math and science and ways to solve problems. And so here in the Kansas City area, we've been really fortunate to have the Kauffman Foundation identify 13 years ago two best practice STEM programs, one that operates in the school day called Project Lead the Way and one that operates in the after-school space, FIRST Robotics. And so we've had great traction here in the Kansas City area where students have been able to solve real-world problems and work in teams. And
can you give an example?
Oh, sure, absolutely. So one of the fifth grade modules is how to identify the host origin for a disease and how does that infection spread.
Origin, that's like
the patient zero. Absolutely. And so we'll talk about that a little bit later because that's been one of our first opportunities that we brought arts into a STEM classroom. But, you know, it's how do you work together as a team to decide, you know, where was that infection first started and how can we identify how that infection started and how do we prevent the spread?
How do fifth graders do that?
Well, with a fabulous teacher, obviously, in the classroom. But, you know, they work through processes and they also learn how viruses spread and how viruses are started. And it's, you know, the opportunity to take that science content and move it into a relative space that's realistic for students. They all can talk about, you know, having a cold or, you know, who got the chicken pox or those types of things.
So how is that different from how I probably learned science separately from math, separately from I didn't learn engineering.
Well, neither did I. And sometimes I think if I'd been exposed to this curriculum, I might find myself in a different career, even though I absolutely love what I do. You know, I think when we look back to the way in which you were learned in school or I learned in school, it was typically out of a textbook with a teacher at the front disseminating all of their knowledge, and our job was to sit there and take it all in and attempt to retain it and then regurgitate it onto a test. And there was no real opportunity to demonstrate what we were learning. And that's what we're seeing change now, is we're seeing students have the opportunity to use a variety of tools to demonstrate their knowledge.
But what about like experiments in the science lab? That's pretty old school.
That is old school, and we did work in teams. I remember my first experience in eighth grade, you know, learning about the eye and with a cow eye, and I have this very, experience, you know, cutting into the eye. And
I noticed you did not choose an adjective there. I had this very experience.
And, you know, the stuff's kind of dripping through your hand. And but you learned a lot. But we didn't get the opportunity to do that many science experiments. You know, there were, you know, maybe two or three in the school year. So it's taking that kind of science experiment experience and embedding it in all of their classes.
What is the argument? I mean, part of this is an argument for a concerted focus on these subject areas and the integration of these subject areas. Sure. What's the argument for that?
So the argument for that is that when students leave school, that's how they're going to practice out in the real world when they get a job. You know, you don't have people that are just doing the math or just doing the science. They're working together in teams to solve problems using all of those skills. And so the other piece that's the argument is that this falls under economic viability. So when we have students that have very strong STEM skills and are very comfortable working with their science and math and then also the integration of technology and computer science and the engineering component, is they're eligible to go to work for companies where those skills are highly paid. And so it becomes a real economic benefit to students to develop those STEM skills and go and then work in companies that need those STEM skills.
In other interviews I've conducted, especially with people who have succeeded in STEM kind of fields, especially women and people of color, you will hear a lot of talk about how welcoming those industries and academic fields have historically been for people other than white men, I guess, and at a younger age, white boys. Is that part of the way that a focus on STEM and identifying what that is and how you foster it, is that part of how you see a benefit?
Absolutely. I think that companies who recognize that they need to have diverse employees are going to be further along than their peer companies that don't really see the need for that. And I can tell you right here in Kansas City, I haven't run across a company who's not interested in developing a more diverse workforce. Their problems are solved with more creativity. They actually have better solutions. They might come to a solution quicker, which saves revenue. And we also know that when people come to a problem from different perspectives, they're going to see a solution differently. And so that's why there's value in having more women at the table. That's why there's value in having more people from color, more people from different economic backgrounds, because we all approach problems in a different way.
And that's just does giving the table a name help you do that? I mean, that's, I guess, what I'm asking. Calling it STEM.
I think that people are resonating with the word STEM and understanding that that's the integration of the subjects, and it's really creative problem solving. We have people ask us at the Casey STEM Alliance, are you really trying to create a lot of engineers? And the answer is no. I mean, if we get more engineers, that's great. It's great for the student. It's great for our companies here in Kansas City, because we have a lot of wonderful engineering firms. But what we're really wanting to do is create students that are creative problem solvers that are going to go out and solve real world problems, not only here in our backyard, but across our country and across the world. And that's really what we're aiming for.
What do you think about the argument that some people have made that a STEM focus can be detrimental in funneling time and energy into this particular area of interest? Extra time spent on science, technology, and math has to come from something else.
So, I think there's balance in everything. I think that when you have the opportunity to have students get more engaged in STEM, is that what's going to also engage them in school and keep them connected to school? And we know that across the metro, we're looking at increasing graduation rates. We know that we want to keep students engaged in school for a variety of reasons. And we think that STEM is certainly a way to do that. It's potentially a way to identify a skill set in students that maybe they weren't previously engaged.
It seems like that would be STEM for some kids and other things for other kids.
I don't think that we see that in our work. We see kids from a whole variety of backgrounds being really successful, and especially when they have the opportunity to see the relevancy of math and science, when they are working on a STEM project or in a STEM club, all of a sudden things come to light that might not have when they were just sitting in the classroom.
Well, hang on with me. Heidi Van is here, too. She is a theater person. She runs the Fish Tank Theater, so maybe not the most obvious proponent of science and technology in the classroom, but these neat divisions between one discipline and another might not be as clear-cut as we tend to think they are. Heidi Van, good morning.
Good morning.
You have been involved in an artist residency for STEAM, which includes the arts. Can you explain that?
Yes. So Kansas City Young Audience had a workshop where they invited some of their teaching artists to come and learn about STEAM program, which is integrating arts with science and technology, or science and math in schools. And so I was paired up with a second grade class at Crossroads Central Street. And basically you're given a module and then the teacher and you collaborate on like how you can bring this into a different light using like, you know, kind of my background and my training and what I do. And I make theater. I make stories. I make inanimate objects come to life. I am involved with narration and storytelling. And so we had a module about animal adaptations and seed dispersal.
And, what does that mean?
Well, we had like animal adaptations. We talked about how, you know, different animals with different attributes survive in different climates. And so it's like, okay, well, here's the different characters and here's the different sets. And like if this bird has feathers and can it live in this place that's just made of ice? Or, you know, like what type of skin is necessary to survive in these elements? So if your animal lives here, what sort of costume would you put them in to protect them from the elements? Another thing, what kind of beaks do they have? So that was kind of a really fun part. I brought in all these different puppets that belong to my amazing puppet daughter, Pauline, and they all have different shapes of beaks. And so animals in different environments have, or different places have different shapes of beaks so they can eat. So their beaks can get into little things and eat. So I had some pointy beaks and some different containers with little fuzzies in it.
So it sounds to me like you learned the material that the kids were going to learn and then thought about how to present it
right.
theatrically.
Well, I mean, just how to get them involved, but not because I'm not there to do a science show for them. I'm there to like get them involved in my field and experience the module through my field. So they put this on and they went through and they had the experience of being these.
They put on the bird
They put on the bird puppet.
And on their hands.
What's awesome is that you could see their physical frustration when their beak couldn't get in. And it's like, oh, I understand that. Because what is arts also? It is an experience. So like bringing in, you know, an artist to collaborate with the teacher and collaborate with the students, especially theater, which is a collaborative art form, is that when they have that experience, just like you were telling me about the disease, like when something include your whole body and your senses, you remember that. They're going to remember that, oh man, that I bet that bird can't get seeds out of this other thing because its beak is so small because I was that bird.
You know, you're helping them put themselves in a different mindset than second grader in the classroom.
Right.
They're getting in the mindset of bird who needs to
survival.
Yeah.
And another one, I just think this is a really interesting story. So then this other one was about seed dispersal and how seeds travel through the air, through water. It's kind of like, what's the seed's objective? Where is it going? What's the climax? What's the drama? Talk about zone of darkness and like what? So, and kind of, you know, use reader's theater to even when we said the word so that they knew like the conflict and the crisis if the seed didn't get sun or water, you know. I had a blast. I was terrified because, you know, I make theater. But then, you know, it was so much fun. It was so much fun. And they had a good time, too. So,
as a non-education person stepping into this world, what's your take on the whole alphabet soup thing that's going on these days? I mean, did this feel like does using the term STEAM help you wrap your mind around how to step into a classroom and do this?
I mean, not the letters, no, but the idea, the concept behind it. And I had to be shown it as well in this workshop at KCYA. Harlan Brownlee did an incredible presentation how he taught coding using choreography, and that's where like I became a subscriber because I don't know what coding is. Like I'm a history theater person. Like I don't have any of that. And so when he did that, when he relayed his lesson to us, also one about clouds and evaporation, like all of these things. And as I experienced it, I was like, oh my gosh, I get it. But that's how I learn. That's why I am in the career that I'm in. Like, so
can you tell me more about the coding through choreography?
It was awesome. So he had different like little squares, different colored squares that he placed on the floor. And so like there's blue square, blue square, blue square. So let's say on the blue squares you hop. Red square, red square, red square, you have like right foot. So it's like your movement was based on what color of square you were jumping on. And I was like, oh, that's how code works.
Yeah.
Like, and then it's also paired with that application that they do. I have a child now in school that is learning off of, you know, these sorts of things as well as an iPad. And so there's an application that also teaches them coding that I don't know what it's called because I don't think Marianne's doing it yet. But it relates to that. It takes it off of a flat screen and where they become the player. They become the code, the response. But that's what I like going. I just wrote that down when we were talking, because it's an experience and it's a full body experience with arts. Like, and you get into this lesson. I mean, those you'll remember that
because that's how you learn things. It's interesting to me. You're kind of reminding me of growing up. I had, especially in high school, really struggled with math and chemistry and physics.
Uh-huh.
And I got to college and had a science math requirement and took this practice in theory of science class.
And I took evolution. I was terrified of science and math in college.
Yeah, but this class had a sort of approach to teaching the history of physics where you kind of learned what the scientists of the time knew, and then you found out what they saw that made people go, wait a minute.
Mm-hmm.
There's something else going on here. And then the professor, I guess, would like leave us with the cliffhanger. And then we'd come back and be like, here's the deal. And so instead of teaching it by theme, like now we're learning about magnetism
right.
or now we're learning
right.
about the structure of an atom.
Mm-hmm.
I was being told the story of the history of discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And as a person who learns through narrative,
right.
I finally got it.
Yeah.
And actually was doing calculus in this class, which I had avoided like the plague
uh-huh.
for my whole previous academic career.
Right.
I didn't even know it was called calculus till someone else informed me that the problem I was doing was calculus.
Oh my gosh.
I would have freaked out if I had known.
Yeah.
But this sounds like kind of a similar idea that when that you could understand coding when it was,
when it was shown
characters
to me,
hopping onto things.
Mm-hmm. Or at least the concept of that. Like, oh, that's how it communicates. It's this means this. Yeah.
But Martha McCabe, why do we need the acronyms? Why can't education just become more integrated without each component that exists having to be a letter in an acronym? What is actually going on here that this is how we talk about education?
You know, I think it would be great if we got to a place where we didn't need the acronyms, where school was truly integrated from the moment they step in the door to the moment that they leave. We're not there yet. Will we get there? I would hope so. So, you know, I don't right now. The acronym, I think, is needed to talk about the way in which we want students to learn. But I think there'd be a great opportunity to get to a place where we didn't need that.
Call 816-235-2888 with your take. Has STEM helped you or someone you know, or do you think other areas of learning have taken a hit? If so, is STEAM or STREAM the answer, or is it time to just talk about plain old school? 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman talking about STEM in education and the variations on that acronym that are gaining popularity. STEAM with an A for the arts, STREAM with an R for reading. There's even something we have not talked about yet, but we will, called, wait for it, Hamster. The H is for humanities. Call 816-235-2888 to join the conversation. My guests are Martha McCabe of the KC STEM Alliance and Heidi Van, who's used her theater background to teach science through a STEAM residency. Hi again, you guys.
Hello.
Morning.
Martha McCabe, real quick, Hamster.
That was awesome. I was in Pittsburgh with the Carnegie Science Center working through a STEM education rubric, and they brought up Hamster. And we all looked around like, what are you talking about? And they were like, oh, yeah, it's humanities, arts, math, science, technology, engineering, reading. And then,
in other words, school.
School, absolutely. And to our point right before we went to break, you know, let's make school be so integrative and engaging that we don't need the acronyms anymore.
Well, now we're going to bring in another guest. I want to talk to Rob Furman. He wrote an article on all of this for the Huffington Post a few years back, which was part of the whole movement to update STEM and make it STEAM. He's an elementary school principal in Pennsylvania. Hi, Rob.
Hi. How's everybody doing today?
Good. How are you?
Doing wonderful. I've been enjoying listening to everybody, and we agree on a lot of things, so that's a nice place to start.
Well, what was your argument for STEAM back in 2014?
Well, it was really when you get into the notion of STEM, and then you get into STEAM, and then you get into STREAM, and then this whole concept of the hamster. It all boils down to, like you've been saying, good schooling. What I had noticed back then when I wrote that piece was my concern of these quote-unquote STEM schools that are popping up, and a lot of grant money are dedicated to the STEM initiatives and things like that, which is fine. But the problem is I noticed people forgetting, at least in my opinion, were forgetting the arts and reading and the humanities and things like that. And sometimes when you get yourself into that pigeonhole type of mindset, the other things do have a tendency to lose value or to just simply be forgotten.
What were the signs to you that people were devaluing or forgetting those other subject areas?
Just even as simple as, you know, the news, the conversations, everything going on in the STEM. I do a lot with futurism, so we look at things that are coming up in 5, 10, 20 years in education, and the whole idea of humanities was completely falling off the program. We weren't seeing it being emphasized whatsoever, even to the point now where social studies is something that's integrated into reading, and you really, a lot of schools don't have social studies classes anymore. And again, not that that's a bad thing, just that we've got to make these changes in a positive fashion. And I think that was my concern when I wrote it, and it's still my concern now.
Well, can I just stop you for a second?
Yes.
Because social studies falling off of curriculum does seem like a pretty big deal to me. You're saying that it's integrated into reading. Is there anything that ensures that everything you covered in social studies is finding its way into that reading material?
Well, here we do, but I don't necessarily know that that's happening on a countrywide scale or whatnot. But the when people start saying, we don't need to learn facts and figures anymore, which I completely agree with. I don't need to know the names of generals. I don't need to know the dates. However, that doesn't mean that there isn't an important learning experience to understand the times of what was going on during that wars and those conflicts. And
the lessons of our collective past.
Absolutely. So I think when people think facts and figures, they instantly go to generals and dates, but then they throw out the baby with the bathwater, you know? So it becomes a situation where we've lost it all, as opposed to making changes. And I get it. We're the Wild West of educational technology. We're just trying to learn how to use this stuff properly. I'm sure when they write about us in the history books, we've made our fair share of trips and falls. But we have to be really careful not to go overboard and lose some of these critical elements.
Can I just ask you, I'm sorry to get hung up on teaching social studies through reading, but I'm genuinely shocked. My concern is not just that you would lose some of the content of social studies, but also that reading would then be strictly a vehicle for the content, and that reading stories that are there just for the joy of reading and the power of literature, that, I mean, I'm biased, I suppose, as someone with a background in writing, but can you tell me, I mean, is there any, does reading kind of suffer as something valuable in its own right?
And that's, I would think, is the million-dollar question. And my wife is a eighth-grade social studies teacher, so we've had these conversations many, many times. And I think the problem that we're running into as a whole is that we only have 8 hours a day. There's only so much we're going to shove into that 8 hour time with these kids. And then we get them in doing homework and all that stuff in the evenings, which, you know, I'm not even sure is entirely fair. As a person who works a 40 hour week, 8 hour day, I don't want to have to go home and put two or three more hours of my work day in at home. And that's what we're asking our kids to do. So we only have 8 hours a day. Something's got to give. Something's got to give. And I understand that. The problem being is, what's going to give?
Is that why we have these acronyms? I mean, that's something that has occurred
possibly.
To me. Is that there's this grab for resources, and if you put a label on something and make the case for it, maybe that's a way to grab some time or some money.
Grant money, yeah. Absolutely. And the interesting thing is the STEM, they've really got it going on right now because you can buy toys and things that have STEM written across the front, which is great marketing because as a parent, I see a toy called STEM. I know my kid goes to a class that is like Project Lead the Way or a STEM initiative type of class. And you know, when it comes to looking at cutting things and moving things around, that's not going to get touched. By the way, my high school here where I am in my school district is a Project Lead the Way award-winning school. So we have that in our district, and it's an amazing program. So I don't want anybody to think that I'm not in agreement with the whole STEM initiative. I think it's a fabulous thing. I just think we need to be careful what we maneuver around in order to make the time to have those initiatives. And, you know, from a futurist point of view, we need to really throw up the whole idea of how education was created. It was created back in 1892 by the Committee of Ten, and you know,
wait,
we're still looking
that
way today. The Committee of Ten?
Yeah.
The Committee of Ten in 1892. There were 10 gentlemen that created the concept of what public education was going to look like, the whole idea of standardizing. They had three organizations from which to choose from, the church, the jail, and the factory. From the jail, we get our idea of compliance and walking the straight line, yard time, which we call yearbook, which we call recess, the yearbook, which we call the mugshot, the factory. Everything was standardized. Everything came out the exact same way. We still teach to standards.
You're blowing my mind.
I'm going
to
write a play about this.
And then you have the church, which is the whole idea of our instructional practices. You sit up front, the teacher stands up front, you sit down in front, you listen, you be quiet. I will give you the knowledge that I think you need at this time, no more, no less, and you're supposed to sit there and take it in and learn it. End of story. So, you know, that's what we were created, and we're still that today. So, you know, maybe it's time that we start. Instead of teaching math class, science class, maybe we teach a STEM class. Maybe we teach a critical thinking class or a problem solving class and blend these things together. Because just like the lady said at the very beginning, that's the real world. We don't do math in isolation in the real world. Pages and pages of computation. What good is that? Someone said something about calculus. I learned algebra. Man, you gave me a sheet of computation, I could do that sucker blindfolded. You asked me to take the concepts of algebra and solve a problem in the real world, I'm toast. Not a chance. I have no idea how it works. I can do it, but I don't have any relevance to it in the real world.
I do.
That's
in
what we need to do with
time.
Our kids. We need to get to the idea of word problems and problem solving using this knowledge.
Man,
that's where we have to end up.
This has been a mind-blowing rant on live radio, and I love
it.
No, I love it.
I have a tendency to get worked up.
I love it. Martha McCabe, chime in here. This is the executive director of the Casey STEM Alliance.
Well, that was awesome. You know, it's interesting because we talk about, you know, how do you take all those subjects and to your point, Rob, make them relevant. And I think what we're really looking at is how do we develop these transportable skills where kids have the opportunity to learn something and then demonstrate that either to the public or to their parents about what they've learned. And I was talking with some engineers, and they said, you know, there's kind of two kinds of kids or people that we see. Those that have great ideas and don't say anything, they don't know how to communicate their ideas. And then those that don't have very good ideas, but they're wonderful communicators. And all of a sudden you have the team going down, you know, the direction because the kid who had the great the idea that he could communicate might not be very good. They're headed down the wrong path. And so Yeah, I think there's opportunities, especially as you start to see the integration of arts, where kids learn different ways in which to communicate their solutions. And that's one thing that I'm really excited with this arts piece. And we see that in classrooms, and we see that in after-school programs, where kids have the opportunity to use a variety of tools to communicate their solutions.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk to our callers. We've got a couple people who want to join this conversation. I'm going to talk first with John in Midtown. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How about you?
Doing well, thank you.
What's your question?
First of all, I'd like to say my wife is involved with this project that Harlan Brownlee's doing with Coding with Choreography, and thanks for the shout out for that. That was she's very proud of that, as is Harlan. My question is more about the other end of the spectrum, sort of that 9 through 12 grades, and I guess if I boiled my question down, it would be, so we've seen Kauffman Foundation get involved with Project Lead the Way for about 15 years. That would mean that kids would have maybe gone through K through 12 with more emphasis on STEM. Are we seeing more students go into college in technology, science, engineering related areas? And what can we do in the future, in the next 5 years, to help encourage more of that?
Okay, so Martha, this seems like something that's up your alley.
Sure. So we have been able to identify students that have gone through different in-depth STEM programs, whether it's Project Lead the Way or others, and come out the other side, and now they're young associates. And what we're really seeing, both at the collegiate level and then at the associate level with companies here in the Kansas City region, is the persistence piece. So we know from some of our colleges who are doing studies on our Project Lead the Way students that they are persisting through and receiving their degrees. And we know that that's really important for girls. We want to see girls persisting through those degrees at the same rate that boys are. And then when they show up in their employment opportunities, if they've been in these STEM integrative experiences through high school, both during the school day and in the out-of-school space, they matriculate a lot easier into the workforce, where they have to work in teams and they have to learn how to communicate in different ways. And so we're starting to see the benefits of that investment by the Kauffman Foundation. This is the 13th academic year that Project Lead the Way and FIRST Robotics will be here in Kansas City. And so we're starting to see those kids come through the pipeline and out the other end. And it was interesting, I was visiting with the Kansas City Civic Council yesterday, and they are doing focus groups with college students and new associates as part of the Casey Rising work and the Talent Industry Exchange work in global design. And they said they were sitting at in Manhattan at K-State and talking to a group of engineering students, and they asked them, you know, how did you get involved? And almost resoundingly, all of them said they're Project Lead the Way classes. And so we're really seeing the benefit of that investment here locally.
Rob Furman, just as someone who has this futurist perspective, as you've put it, I assume that part of what you are looking at is what STEM has been, what the results have been so far, and what trajectory that puts us on. Do you want to add anything?
Sure. There's a couple things we can look at in terms of this idea of STEM. And I think when we look at STEM, we could call that sort of the math science initiative, because the other element that we're looking at in the near future is the idea of the personalized learning, the idea where we get rid of the standardization and we let kids start focusing early on their passions and their interests and what they're really aiming towards. And I think STEM is going, when we look back from our future into our past, we're going to see that STEM has been the first element of that type of personalized learning. If you're a student, you've found an interest in this area, there's now this pathway that you can go through, really starting in kindergarten. We have Project Lead the Way all the way down here into my elementary school. You could actually kind of make your way through your grade levels, hitting that STEM initiative the whole way up through high school. And that is really the key to personalized learning, where you get that interest and you've got a path all the way through to keep yourself impassioned about that particular topic. So I think that STEM and the Project Lead the Way type of scenario is going to be a model that other subjects and elements can use whenever we say, how do we do personalized learning for students? This is really sort of an example of that. This is how you can do that.
Let's talk quickly with Amelia in Kansas City, Missouri. Amelia, what do you want to share?
Well, I was actually working at UMKC in what they call the Supplemental Instruction Program, which is a retention program. It was about 13 years ago. My son's 12 and I left at that time. But we were working with the Kauffman Foundation. They were just starting their Kauffman Scholars Program, where they were sending seventh graders up through and guaranteeing, you know, the support through high school and middle school and into college. And we developed a curriculum for them, and we based it on what we called what is called expeditionary learning. I don't know if any of your experts there are familiar with that.
Rob, expeditionary learning?
No, I have not heard of that.
Martha McCabe, well, are you?
I've not heard of that term, but I like where you're headed, so just describe
yeah,
that.
Yeah, tell us about it.
And it really speaks to what you're talking about, integration. And first of all, you know, I'm a homeschooler, and I do that partly because of what I saw in expeditionary learning and then what I saw in schools and a real discrepancy. And so what this was, and if you look it up, you may still find it. We had videotapes, and a teacher had taken his fifth grade classroom, I think he's in New England, and they started with nothing, an empty classroom. And the first thing they did was they wrote letters to funders, and they looked up plans, and they decided how much lumber they would need to build their own desk. And they were going to use the tools. This was all as the Pilgrims did it. So the intention here in the learning was about the founding of America. And so they were going to use wooden pegs, and they were going to use hand augers and all this. They had to plan the building materials that they would need and then write letters asking for funding and explain that they would be raising crops and that these people would be investing in their crops. And once the crops were harvested, they would be receiving the bounty. And they had to raise all their crops themselves. They had to do everything. They had to make the bread once they had the wheat. You know, they had to do all of these things. These kids were coming in before and after school. They were so excited. They loved their work. They couldn't wait. They didn't want to leave at the end of the day.
They were building their world.
They were. And it was very much this integration. It was very much this real world concept. And it was all steam or hamster
well,
or
let's,
stream. I mean, everything was there.
Let's hear some response to this from Rob Furman. Hi, Rob.
I think it's a fabulous concept. We've done other things similar like that. We call them cross-curricular activities, where there was a thing back in the late 80s, early 90s called Voyage of the Mimi, where we would do all these cross-curricular activities, actually tracking a whale through the oceans and learning about the ships and all those type of different things. They're excellent opportunities for kids to sort of have those experiences. And when I do my presentations, I always talk about, you know, when you think back into your elementary and middle school lives, those are the experiences that you remember. Like, I remember doing a colonial day in my fifth grade with my teacher, Mr. Homer, and we did this amazing day where we had to dress like the kids. We learned things that the kids, we used the same products. But yet, how many adults could think back and remember their most favorite worksheet? Like, you know, nobody remembers their best worksheet. So we really need to get to these things where we're doing experiences for kids, which rolls right back into the idea of the problem solving and critical thinking.
We're going to have to leave it there. But thank you to everyone who chimed in. And Martha McCabe, Heidi Van, Rob Furman, thank you all.
Thank you.
In just a minute on KCUR Central Standard, new findings on the health of Black men who identify as queer in Kansas City. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and now I'm joined by D. Rashawn Gilmore, the founder of an organization called Blackout with a Q. It's an advocacy group looking to improve the overall well-being of Black gay men in Kansas City. And we spoke to Rashawn last week about a survey he'd used to gather information on what the community he serves really needs. It's called the 2020 survey. Last time we spoke, the findings hadn't gone public, so we're doing a little follow-up. Rashawn, hello.
Hey, Gina. Thanks for having me back.
Thanks for coming back. So a recap for those who couldn't listen last week. This survey has put Kansas City kind of on the cutting edge because of this novel concept that the people you want to help can be the ones to tell you how to help them.
Imagine that, empowering the community by doing research on what their needs are so that we can advance from within. And I have to give credit to Dr. Jeanette Berkeley-Patton, whom I know you will introduce, but she is really the person who seeded me with the idea of doing the survey and doing it in a way that the community was involved in every aspect of it.
We are going to talk to Jeanette in one moment, but what were the main areas or categories you ended up looking into, and what were the big findings you presented? Just the quick like highlights?
So the highlights are there were seven areas that we looked at. They were crime and violence, healthcare access, HIV and sexual health, food, diet, and nutrition, social determinants like housing, home, education, employment, that sort of thing, substance use, and mental health.
What would you identify as like the most revealing takeaways? Like just a couple of things that really surfaced for you that you think the Kansas City area on the whole needs to hear about.
Okay, so while I don't want our lives to be defined by HIV, I cannot not talk about HIV, pardon the double negative. And so one of the things that we looked at was the fact that when it comes to PrEP, which is a once-a-day pill that can prevent HIV-negative people from contracting HIV, 88% of our population had heard of PrEP, but only 12% is actually on it. And it's a huge gap. So that means what's happening is most of the scripts written around PrEP are for white, cisgender, gay men who are affluent or have employment and insurance. And so that's a huge issue. Also around issues of homelessness and hunger, fully a third of our population that we surveyed reported having not had enough food to eat at some point during their week. That is a real problem. And that's something that we can do better about here in Kansas City.
How do you understand that problem?
Well, it's tied to issues of homelessness. We were talking about this, too, in the green room earlier, that very many times a person may be couch surfing, and so they may have a place to stay, but they may not have food. So food scarcity or food insecurity becomes a big problem.
What sends people couch surfing within this particular community?
A number of things. And one of the things you might imagine most is that very often people are kicked out or thrown out of their homes. I just heard of a situation yesterday with a young woman who is trans who was kicked out of her home because her parents found out that she's trans and had queer friends.
So for you, when you find out that in such high numbers, people within the community you serve are going without a meal that they need at some point within any given week, what do you do with that?
Well, I think first we have to look at what are the existing resources, right? So where are the gaps and how can we fill them with existing resources? But I think beyond that, we have got to continue to be innovative and not just keep doing business as usual. And that may make some people uncomfortable, and I'm prepared for that. But we've got to say this is a problem and here's at least one solution for how to address it. And it's worth noting that the CAB, the Community Action Board, came up with 116 different strategies to address these seven core areas that we looked at. So they have their own ideas around how we can implement change, and we should listen to them and follow their lead.
Well, we've invited one of the researchers who you worked with and who you just referenced to join us to look a little more closely at how to interpret the data. Jeanette Berkeley Patton with the UMKC School of Medicine. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. What jumped out to you in the findings of the survey? And then we'll back up.
Yeah, I think some of the things that Rashawn just pointed out were, you know, kind of eye-raising. The fact that many of the respondents had said that they did not have enough food to eat, and the fact that there was such a high level of self-reported non-use of PrEP. I think those two things were really kind of alarming, along with the fact that less than 50% of the participants reported that they had seen a healthcare provider in the last year.
Less than 15%?
Less than
50. Okay.
Yes, which was, you know, somewhat surprising, considering the fact that, you know, healthcare is so important for everyone, but especially for this population that's at risk for many health issues.
So for you, when you think about the relationship between a community-driven conversation, information gathering, all of that, community-driven advocacy, and scientific research, where do those two ideally sync up? Because, yeah, it's an interesting question because science has its own process.
Absolutely. Science does have its own process, but we're in the day and age now where science for science's sake is not enough. We really need to be thinking about how science can have greater benefit for the community that it's supposed to serve. And to do that appropriately, we really need to figure out how to engage the community in the scientific process. And that's what we've done here in many studies that we've done in Kansas City. I do need to say that my research group is the Community Health Research Group at UMKC in the School of Medicine. And in using this health needs assessment approach, we engaged the CAB members from the very beginning in establishing what's going to be done, how it's going to be done, those procedures that will be implemented, and even trained them in how to conduct ethical human research and included them in our IRB application. That's our Institutional Review Board application, so that they could serve as junior researchers and be involved in this entire process.
Does anything in the findings from this survey become the basis for you for a new project, a next step from the perspective of a medical researcher?
Absolutely. As Rashawn mentioned earlier, and like I said, we were talking, chatting about this even in the green room today, the fact that so few of our participants are on PrEP, again, is alarming. And I think that is an area that we definitely can work together and with the Blackout CAB to address. Certainly, there are there's a huge push from CDC right now to get a greater uptake of PrEP, especially for populations that are at greatest risk for HIV. And this would certainly, this work could certainly fill a gap and help benefit our community in this area.
Do I understand, Rashawn, that there's also, there's some findings about the relationship between religion and this community that stood out?
Well, that was a huge eye-opener for me as well. And not surprisingly, for most, I think, people learning that, or our respondents feeling that church or any faith-based locale, and we asked about a variety of them, were not a safe place. I mean, that's alarming. So what happens is you have a population of people who often get disconnected from their faith because the places that they go, at least in congregational format, to celebrate or practice their faith, they're not welcome. And so that was one of the top rated places where our respondents felt like they were not not welcome. And again, the religiosity factor was kind of some might call it duplicitous, but to me, I just think it's a dichotomy because you have some who identify as not very religious, but very spiritual, but not able to practice anywhere where they would normally go to practice their religion.
When you think about just sort of the history of the civil rights movement in this country, the role of the church in that movement has been significant historically. It's interesting to me when you think about that the history of equality is in some ways wrapped up with religious groups pushing for change, and then that at the same time, you have people feeling unwelcome.
Well, I think that, you know, a couple of thoughts. One is that we are living in a time when the modern civil rights movement, if you will, and groups like Black Lives Matter and others are really headed up by queer people of color. The three women founders of Black Lives Matter, for example. So I think that while there is change on some fronts, there's not enough change on other fronts. And I can't think of a single black affirming church or mosque or temple in this city. There may be some other places, but most of our respondents, some 60%, said that they practice Christianity, but they don't have any place to do it.
Can you explain what you mean by black affirming house of worship?
Well, places where they don't just tolerate you being gay or just wink and nod at it or whatever, but they welcome you as you are. You're gay, you're bi, you're trans, you're whatever. Come on in. We welcome you and we affirm you being who you are and we celebrate that. So there's a big difference between, and a lot of our guys have very suppressed sexuality or even gender expression because they cannot be who they are in their houses of worship.
Jeanette, how do you hear this as a scientist, as a researcher?
Well, I think it has many different implications. And in particular, what we saw in the survey is the high levels of depression, which to some degree is consistent with some of the national surveys for this population, and other mental health issues. Also, it could relate to coping skills or coping mechanisms, which could include drug use. And in the survey, we saw that there was a significant population that even uses marijuana daily and more than once a day.
And alcohol.
That was
a big one. I'm sorry, Jeanette.
No, so I was just going to say quickly. So in not being able to live their lives out loud can be related to many other adverse health outcomes.
Rashawn, how do you approach talking about this with the community at large? Because as we've discussed, you're part of the community that you're talking about and working with. There is a certain vulnerability in sharing the struggles of an inside community. You know what I mean? Sharing them with the population at large. Who's going to do with that information, form whatever ideas they might. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I think it speaks to the resiliency of this community. And they are determined to see a Kansas City that's better than the one that they grew up in and the one that they live in. And they want to do it for themselves, but also for future generations. And that you cannot beat. That is our strength.
Well, Rashawn Gilmore, Jeanette Berkeley-Patton, thank you both so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having
us, Gina. Thanks for having us here.
Our time is up, but definitely keep us posted on how all this gets implemented, what change you happen to see as you continue researching this community. Thanks so much again. And that brings this morning's show to a close, but anything you want to hear again or share with a friend will be online at kcur.org/centralstandard. And if you're not available to listen at 10, you know you can listen anytime, right? Subscribe and have these conversations sent to you like a podcast at kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow is a portrait session with filmmaker Kevin Willmott. He's been talking a lot about his new movie with Spike Lee, The Black Klansman. But what is his story? How'd he forge this career making Hollywood movies from Kansas? What are the stories in his own life that shaped his perspective on race in America? Kevin Willmott, tomorrow at 10. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Suzanne Hogan, and Kathleen Pointer. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date.